but I needed to raise a couple million dollars to get this thing funded and get it off the ground. So I quit Google, I quit my cushy job, I left all my stock options on the table, all my RSUs I'd been given. It was worth a couple million dollars, and I was 25 years old back in 2005, so it was a big deal. And I did it without being fully funded. And Danny's like, I'll introduce you to all the VCs in the Valley. I had met two of them from Google's board meetings, Mike Moritz and John Doerr, so I emailed them and reached out, and they both said no. And then Danny introduced me around, and all the VCs I met said no. And I was like, well, shit, what do I do now?
Holy shit.
What's up, boys and girls, CEOs and investors, founders and scraping ChatGPTs. Welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Today's guest is no one else than David Friedberg, also known as the Sultan of Science on the Internet. David is the founder and CEO of The Production Board, a holding company that builds and invests in businesses that solve the most fundamental problems that affect our planet by reimagining global systems of production. Prior to The Production Board, he was the founder and CEO of The Climate Corporation, which he sold for $1.1 billion to Monsanto. Spanning his career, he has contributed to 32 patents. On the fun side, he's also the co-host of the All In Pod, the super popular podcast co-hosted together with David Sachs, Chamath Palihapitiya, and Jason Calacanis, where they talk all things science, markets, venture capital, and politics, which I highly recommend you to listen to. During this episode, we'll discuss about the founding story of the Climate Corporation and the exit to Monsanto, why as an entrepreneur you should always be biased towards action, and his deep optimism and his vision of reimagining Earth. Thanks a million to Jan Hammer from Index Ventures and Siraj Kalik from Atomico for the input to this episode. Very, very much appreciated, guys. Please enjoy this geeky conversation with the Sultan of Science, David Albert Friedberg. But before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors, which make this show possible. This episode is brought to you by Rose, the spreadsheet where data comes to life. Connected with your business data and delightful to share, Rose is how teams work with numbers and share their results. Head to rose.com/ventureeurope and find out how you can easily manage your cap table, plan your next fundraising round, or import data from your favorite tools. I already moved my spreadsheet to Rose, and you can too. See for yourself how you can make your data come to life for free and visit rose.com/ventureeurope. That is ROWS.com/ventureeurope. I have already prepared some templates like cohort analysis, fundraising tracker, and cap table management, which I'm sure you'll find useful. David, what an honor. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm such a big fanboy, as probably hundreds of thousands of people across the world. What I really like about you is that you always manage to be very objective and data-driven. Were you always very data-driven? And how do you balance data and intuition now?
I always tell people one of my three big predictors of entrepreneurial success is bias to action. Bias to action often means, you know, once you have a sense of something that change that's needed, that you don't delay and you make the change. And often that means acting on limited information or limited data. I had a guy who led my data science team who managed all of our model development back in the day when machine learning was in its infancy. We called it data science. And before that, we called it math and statistics. And this guy always said, you can never have too much data and you can never have too little data, right? Any amount of data gives you more than none and gives you predictive capability. And the more data you get, the better your predictive capability gets. So to your question, I think that there's some element of what's your priority to act fast or to act right. A lot of people end up causing more harm by waiting for the latter, which is acting perfectly. And then you end up spending most of your time, whether it's in business or in life, analyzing and waiting for the right answer to get all of the data you possibly could get for making a decision. And the reality is a bias to action can often be a bigger predictor of success than, you know, modeling the right outcome and making a you know, what feels like a safer decision. I'm probably a high bias to action person, but I always want to make sure I'm making directional decisions with some degree of data.
Jeff Bezos said you need to make the decision with 60 or 70% of the data, because if you wait until 100%, probably you're a little bit too late.
A lot of people that have been quote unquote traditionally successful people in their careers, they've been successful because they've done known things where you do a thing, you know what the outcome is going to be, and therefore you get that outcome. And therefore you feel accomplished and you continue down that path The problem is it keeps you from doing things that are, call it unknown or unknowable, like new things like entrepreneurism. And I've seen a lot of friends who worked at Google, for example, or a big, you know, pick any big tech company. They went to a good high school, they got good degrees, grades, they got into a good university, they got great grades at the university, they got the good job at the big tech company, and they assumed that they were good and successful and that therefore they could go build a company and they could go be a successful entrepreneur. The problem with entrepreneurship, however, is that as you make decisions, you often are wandering into the unknown. It's not a known quantity what to do. It's not a known decision, known path. So you then make a decision, you fail. And it's that feeling of failure that happens for the first time, where you're almost like drowning in a pool. You're in this place where you don't know where you're supposed to go next. And that's a very discomforting feeling for people that have been traditionally successful, because everything has been a well-worn path and they know which steps to take. And that really kind of speaks to the point about how much data is enough. I've seen friends who are consultants working at a firm like McKinsey, for example, and they're used to the data gathering analysis process. And in many cases, there isn't enough data to give you that perfectly described path of where to go in entrepreneurism. Then they gather all this data, they do all this analysis, and then they take a step and it doesn't take them where they thought it was going to take them. But they spent all this time gathering all this data and doing all this analysis. And then all of a sudden they feel like a failure and this thing didn't work. And then they have some way to rationalize why they're going to go do something else with their life or their career. And I think that that's been like, you know, the biggest kind of, I think, learning for people that have been through entrepreneurism in a successful way, meaning they found a path, they found a business, they built a business that actually worked and had good unit economics and was scalable and had a great product market fit initially and so on, is and then ultimately scaled it to becoming a platform and other things, is that those people had to at some point get comfortable with the fact that the next step they were taking was going to be taken without all the data and all the analysis. And again, if you spend all your time doing data gathering and analysis, you run out of time. Because the thing about startups and the thing about life is there's limited time and there's limited capital. And then, you know, burning away that time is a huge cost.
And do you remember the first time that you have failed?
I mean, I did a lot of great jobs growing up that I think were always important for me. I would encourage anyone that wants to be an entrepreneur to make sure that you get experience cold calling. I don't know if you've ever cold called, but it's a similar sort of feeling where you're jumping into the unknown. You don't know who's going to pick up on the other side. You don't know what they're going to say, and you don't know how you're going to deal with that. That little kind of training exercise of cold calling people and then managing the sale on, you know, trying to get them to do something or buy something over the phone is a really important muscle to strengthen, because it then plays out so much more importantly later in life, like making these tough decisions about where do I go into the unknown? Am I comfortable doing that? How do I sell someone that I've never met before? How do I get a customer to buy a product? How do I get an employee to come and work here or a team member to join me? And so I had two cold calling jobs in college. One was for Morgan Stanley for the brokerage office, like I cold called college students to sell them on setting up brokerage accounts. You know, I pitched them on high interest rate, you know, which are basically money market funds, to get them to do it over having a checking account. And my broker ended up being, I was just the cold called guy. I got, you know, $10 bounty for every person I signed up. I got him to be like number one in the country for new accounts open that quarter. So I really like pushed myself to get better at that. And then I worked for the alumni fund where you cold call alumni and you try and get them to donate to college. I think like those were really important. So then I went out, I started my company years later. I was 25 years old and I'm cold calling and going to conferences, trying to sell people on this crazy weather insurance idea I had, which was go to this website, your business is affected by weather, buy insurance against the weather. And so I would go to like the National Golf Course Owners Association or the Car Wash Association or the, you know, Ski Operators Association, like all these different conferences, and I'd set up booths and I would be, you know, on the front lines trying to sell customers and doing biz dev deals. I did a biz dev deal with like Priceline.com, another one with Syngenta. And it was always like you go in and you have to go, you don't know how the message will be received. So this is a classic kind of like salesmanship muscle, but it is about failure because, you know, you're not going to close everyone you meet. In fact, you're going to have very few closes and you have to keep going when you get knocked down and they say no and they say no and they say no and they keep slamming doors in your face. You got to keep going. I tried to raise money for my company when we first set it up. I was at Google. It was 2006. And Danny Reimer gave me, you know, from Index Ventures, had given me a check for, I think, $300,000 or $250,000 or something like that to leave Google to start my company, but I needed to raise a couple $1 million to get this thing funded and get it off the ground. So I quit Google. I quit my cushy job. I left all my stock options on the table, all my RSUs I'd been given. It was worth a couple $1 million, and I was 25 years old back in 2005, so it was a big deal. And I did it without being fully funded. And Danny's like, I'll introduce you to all the VCs in the Valley. I had met two of them from Google's board meetings, Mike Moritz and John Doerr. So I emailed them and reached out, and they both said no. And then Danny introduced me around, and all the VCs I met said no. And I was like, well, shit, what do I do now?
Holy shit.
So then I had to go like talk to all my buddies that I worked with at Google who made a bunch of money in the IPO, and I got like a pass the hat going. And I raised like $2.2 million from friends and like networking to other people that Danny had introduced me and that my friends introduced me to. And finally, I like cobbled together $2.2 million. And that was the money that we used to start Weatherbill. From the get-go, it was failure. From the get-go, it was rejection. It was, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this. And then I launched the thing in January of 2007, and I'm going to conferences and trade shows trying to sell the product, and everyone's saying no, no, no. And you know, it's easy to give up when everyone says no. It's like, what do I do? This was my great idea. I launched this thing, no one wants to buy it. But rather than take the no as this isn't gonna work, I took the no as this is what I gotta go change. And the bias to action was, let's go figure out what to change about the product. Let's go figure out how to change the pitch on it, how to change the pricing, how to change the payment schedule. Like, we tried every iteration and eventually found all sorts of models that worked, and eventually focused on agriculture and kept changing. And suddenly the thing really like took off around 2010. And so that was like, you know, 2009, 2010. Yeah, so that was like a really big shift in the business that I think the whole point was we were constantly failing. And, you know, the iteration is what really drove business to success.
Yeah, I'm happy that you mentioned Danny. So just had a chat also like with his colleague Jan just before the chat with you. And he said that you are just like an incredible visionary. And to have the vision with Weatherbill back in 2005 is just incredible. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what is Weatherbill? How did you come up with the idea? And then looking back, what kept you motivated to push? Because probably you did have some data telling you this should exist, this should be in the market, but probably I'm not there yet with the product.
So there were two like observations. The first was I would drive past this place called the Bike Hut, and it rents bicycles on the waterfront in San Francisco, right where I used to live. And I would drive past every day. And then when it was raining, the Bike Hut would be closed down and they wouldn't rent bikes. And I was like, oh, that's a pretty crappy business. Like, whether or not this guy makes money is like whether or not it rains. So that does not seem like a good company. I feel really bad for that guy. I wonder if there's a thing called weather insurance. And so I kind of had that thought that like, you know, but it was always like a smoldering observation, right? Nothing you really act on. Then there was a day when I was sitting, I used to play a lot of poker back in my late teens, early 20s. And I'd be sitting at a card club in the Bay Area, like these seedy, disgusting card rooms. You know, I was sitting at this one card table, and this guy was like a trader, a derivatives trader. And he started telling me about how Enron came about because of the energy deregulation in the mid-90s. I think it was 96. And then Enron kind of created this massive market for trading energy and all the related infrastructure. And one of the things Enron pioneered was weather derivatives, where you could basically buy a swap or derivative on temperature, because the warmer it got, the more people turned their air conditioners on and the hub. And so the price of energy shot up. And the more cold it got, the more people turned their heaters on and the price of energy shot up. And so Enron had created this kind of like, you know, synthetic energy demand swap based on the weather. And it was well traded. But I said, why doesn't the weather derivatives market exist to all industries? Because 70% of companies are affected by the weather. And so that was kind of the connection of like the observation on the Bike Hut being shut down. And there's this interesting financial instrument. And yeah, theoretically, you could sell insurance on the weather. There's plenty of weather data feeds. You don't need to have a insurance claim, et cetera. And then the third was I was a product manager on AdWords. And I worked on the real-time auction system that places the ads on Google search results. And it was really like this incredible system to me to see like how distributed computing enabled what would otherwise seem like very compute-intensive tasks to be resolved very immediately and very affordably from a compute perspective. And I said, well, why don't we do that with weather data? And then we could simulate the weather, and then we could let people have a website where they could specify the weather events that would cause weather loss, or revenue loss, like a ski resort that shuts down when it's not enough snow, or a golf course that shuts down when it rains. They could type that in, and then we give them a price instantly, and they can buy it online. So that was the idea. It kind of connected those three things, and talked with an engineer at Google named Siraj, who's a partner at Atomico in Europe. Siraj was an early engineer at Google, been around forever, so I thought I could like get him to leave and come and do this with me. So we started to kind of play with this, and you know, I wrote all the pricing scripts in R, Siraj wrote the R Java connector and wrote the server-side stuff. And, you know, we kind of worked on the front end jointly, you know, mocked this thing up and used it as a demo to show to people. And, you know, that's how I ended up kind of getting the thing going.
Hi, this is Siraj with a few words to add. So, leaving Google with Dave to start Weatherbill. Funnily enough, that was basically a no-brainer for me. 2006 was actually still a terrible year for VC, and Google was the place to be if you were in tech. But Dave was just so damn compelling with his now or never reasoning. I was already predisposed to leaving. I'd moved to the Valley myself to start something, but I wasn't about to take that step with just about anyone. Dave and I had been friends long enough that it was clear to me he was the person you'd want leading when things get rough, as they do just all the time in startups. First, he was just unrelenting. VCs now call this grit. This is a guy who just doesn't give up. Then there was his quick mind, just effortlessly extrapolating where the world is going, where there's a gap for a new product, and just as importantly, when to throw out something you've been doing and start again. And then add to that his talent for selling, whether it's selling customers, investors, prospective new joiners, inspiring the team over and over again as you need to do. You could just say he was born to start companies. Now that I'm a VC myself, and I've worked with many capable founders, I'm still very surprised just how rare Dave's combination of skills is. Though it has to be said, I was pretty relieved when he stopped writing code.
I don't know about being a visionary, because ultimately that business became the predominant software platform for farmers and was bought by Monsanto in 2013. So I certainly had no vision or intention of doing that. But you know, I think the more apt term instead of being a visionary is a little bit more of a persistent iterator is what I would kind of call myself. And so, yeah, then again, we launched in all these verticals. We focused on agriculture around 2009, 2010. And then we really started to tune the product interface for being perfect for farmers. We changed the pricing terms that work for farmers. We found that farmers are such a great fit because they put their whole balance sheet on the line every year. The biggest driver for whether or not they make money is the weather. And at the end, and they operate on 10 to 20% margin, sometimes less. So it was a perfect fit for farmers. And we figured out how to make it fit with existing products they were buying. We figured out how to get insurance agents that they already go to sell it for us and to market it. We built a new interface that was based on their crop and showed them all these visuals related to their farming practices. And then we started to ingest all this data. Beyond just the weather data, we started to ingest historical farm data, like what did they plant, what was their harvest, what was their yield, satellite data, radar data. And we built all this, these models that related all these data sets together. And those data sets, as a result, could be more predictive of how the weather drives outcome in farming. But it was also had all these really interesting underlying models, like how much moisture is in the soil, what is the growth stage of the plant, what is the yield of the field? When is the field going to be harvestable? So all of these underlying models that made our weather insurance work more in a more kind of seamless and simple way for farmers were actually very useful. And farmers started to buy our insurance just to see the data that we were showing every day and just to track their crop. And then we spun that off as its own product where we said, here's climate.com. It's our kind of farm analytics tool. And that really took off. I think we had about 10 million acres, which is a pretty sizable area, about, you know, I think that's about 4 million hectares, sign up to use this product, which we made free initially. And then we had the idea of charging for certain add-ons, certain models, like it would recommend what seed to use and recommend what fertilizer to use and how much to use and when to apply it in what parts of your field. We had super high resolution maps of every one of your fields ingested. So super, it was like Zillow for farming, where you could click on your farm on a map and then it would give you all this data about your farm. And that hadn't existed before we put all that together on the internet. And so, yeah, that software platform, Monsanto acquired the business for that. And it very quickly scaled. Today, almost 200 million acres globally pay a subscription fee of some sort to use that software. And I think 80% of harvesters and tractors in the US have an iPad that runs that software and it's connected to the farm equipment. And so, yeah, it became over time just like a very deeply kind of integrated analytical tool for agriculture. And, you know, I think that it was not at all what I intended to do with the business. So I don't know if I could possibly call myself a visionary based on where we ended up from where we started.
Hey guys, I just want to take a second to tell you about a private membership network we're launching in June. It is for founders and tech CEOs that raised a minimum 3 million euros or they are at 1 million euro annual recurring revenue. We'll have a monthly meetup facilitated by an executive coach and a yearly gathering in a fancy location. We already have some well-known names from the tech ecosystem signed up, from seed stage to unicorns to bootstrap founders. If you're interested to join, head up to ventureeurope.eu and sign up. We'll see a link under resources. Persistent iterator. I like that. Do you think you sold it too soon? Do you have any regrets on that?
No, I think if you ask people that work in and around the industry, a lot of people call the acquisition of Climit by Monsanto because they paid $1.1 billion. So, and it was like a really big outcome for our investors. It was a really big outcome, more importantly, for the industry. So everyone paid attention to it. And it suddenly set off this land grab race, strategic battle amongst all the players in agriculture. Suddenly they woke up to the fact that software in agriculture is real and it's valuable, and we need to find our place in this marketscape as it evolves, because it's going to change, and it is changing, and it has changed the industry. If farmers move away from gut and intuition and instinct, and they start using data and analytics to make decisions, it has a profound effect on the ag inputs market, meaning what products they're buying, how they're buying them, how they're using them, and the role of all the players in the agricultural inputs ecosystem. The companies that make the seed, the companies that make the fertilizer, the retailers that service the farmers, the agronomists that help support them and what to do, all the farm equipment companies, and everyone in that value chain is very worried about being commoditized. So suddenly everyone started thinking about software and how do I use software? I want to own the farmer customer through my software platform. And, you know, 99% of what was built is absolutely terrible. Just like, you know, hiring terrible consultants or hiring some terrible big company to build a software tool for you. And the product sucked, but it caused a lot of money to start swashing around the transaction that Monsanto did. As a result, of course, a lot of venture investors started pouring money into what they started to call ag tech. And this whole kind of ag tech ecosystem caught on fire. There have been one or two kind of VC-backed exits, Granular, which I was involved in because we helped with the restructuring at the beginning, because we took over the soil lab and they took this company called Solem and recrafted it as Granular. And we had a shared investor in Coastal Ventures there. And then a company called Blue River, where I was also an investor with Jorge, and he was acquired by John Deere. But besides those two, in the traditional kind of digital, call it a world, those have been the two big kind of outcomes. There's obviously a lot more that goes on in agriculture that does not get as much media attention, like all the work in biologics and seed technology. You know, genomics has become digitized effectively. So because of that, we see just a tremendous amount of innovation happening on the biological side that doesn't get all the kind of mainstream media press and attention, but really is continuing to push agriculture forward. I mean, agriculture is like human civilization's first real technology endeavor, right? And it has always been technology. I mean, like if you just live off of what's on the earth and what the earth just, you know, falls off the trees and whatever food is lying around, you're not going to last very long. I mean, you know, the precursor to modern humans were pretty starving, running around on the savannah looking for food. And then at some point we figured out that we could actually engineer the earth and plant stuff in the ground and grow things out of it and eat it. That was engineering. And then we started to breed those plants and pick the bigger ones. And we started to do plant breeding as an engineering process. And, you know, the history, and then, you know, the tractor gave us incredible leverage over the land, and fertilizer gave us incredible leverage over every acre. We could increase the production so much more. So if you go through kind of the spectrum of what's happened in agriculture, so much of what we take for granted today and dismiss as non-tech really is the original tech, whether it's kind of mechanical engineering, chemical engineering, or nowadays biochemical engineering, bioengineering. Agriculture continues to be kind of the tip of the spear in terms of the application of human engineering potential, and you know, digital is just kind of one frosting on that. So
I remember actually reading in What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly this very beautiful explanation of technology, which is like you have biology, which is the logic of the bio, of the nature, yeah. And then you have technology, which is the logic of something that is crafted. And to your point, I think the first technology we had came from agriculture.
Yeah.
If we take a step back, tell us maybe a little bit about the production board. What's the mission and how do you guys go about building a product and bringing a product to the market?
Yeah, so we're kind of, generally speaking, an investor. You know, we have a number of companies that we've run through what we call our foundry program that we're investors in. So we will often kind of build a thesis around some evolution of one of the markets we operate in, whether it's food or agriculture, human health. We increasingly do a lot more work in human health, and generally this kind of intersection of digital biology, you know, plays out not just in food and agriculture, but very deeply and meaningfully across human health and those markets. We will then spend time, once we either read a paper or start meeting with engineers or learn about some evolution, like in AI, and think about the application of, for example, new technologies in AI to therapeutic drug discovery. Then we'll spend time trying to map out and identify how the market's going to change, how are the pharma companies going to respond, or in the case of agriculture, right? How is seed technology going to change? How are the input companies going to respond? And then we will develop, you know, kind of a thesis around what do we think is possible. We will then invest against that thesis. So we'll either make an investment in an existing business and we go out and kind of meet with companies in that space, or we will start a company and we'll kind of bring together a team. Usually, you know, start with the technical team and a founder and start to build the business in-house. So we kind of run this foundry program, and we'll be kind of typically the sole or early backer of those foundry projects until we start to bring in other investor partners into them. I would say, generally speaking, our mission is to reimagine Earth. And, you know, a lot of the stuff we've talked about today fits in that. I think there's human potential is always seemingly limitless. Our thesis, our orientation is one of deep optimism. So, you know, a lot of people talk about the climate crisis and the world is ending and it's a cataclysmic resolution to humanity. But if you go back in history, we've had these sorts of conversations throughout human history. And there's always been some existential crisis that humanity's been faced with. I mean, we talked earlier about the ancestors to humans roaming the plains of the savannah 200,000 years ago, not having any food. You better believe they were sitting there feeling like they were existentially threatened. They had no food. And at some point, someone had to invent the solution of agriculture. And when that happened, humans had abundance. At that moment, you know, imagine going from roaming the plains of the savannah, eating berries off the ground and finding dead carcasses, to suddenly being able to materialize your own food from the ground. That was an incredible technology transformation for humans. And it brought humans in that moment to an era of extraordinary abundance. That abundance did not even seem feasible prior to the realization of that technology event. The same was true, I would say, of the fertilizer crisis in the late 19th, early 20th century. All farms in Europe fed by fertilizer harvested off the South American coasts and the Atacama Desert. And those fertilizer supplies ran dry. And as they were running dry, the world thought we were going to run out of food again and we were all going to die. And then we had a population bomb in the mid 20th century. And we thought we were all going to die. And then, you know, the Black Plague in the 14th century. And then we developed medicines and solutions to resolve that. And suddenly these medicines could actually kill infections. In every one of these moments, we were faced with some existential threat. Human ingenuity prevailed. And post that human ingenuity moment, there was an era of abundance. And I think that we're going through that moment right now, where the technologies that I see from energy production, which is a big area that we're starting to spend more time in, to human health and therapeutics, where we now have this interestingly identified ability to rejuvenate cells and create what is a veritable fountain of youth, not to mention all the cell and gene therapies that are effectively going to eradicate most major diseases, to all the stuff we've talked about in agriculture. And you look across the board and you ask yourself, there's a portfolio of low likelihood but high impact things that humans are working on today. If any one of these things actually works out, like fusion energy or the Yamanaka factor reprogramming of cells to make everyone youthful again, or, I mean, you know, take the long list, it will feel like we will enter this era of abundance once again. And so our orientation is one of optimism. I don't feel existentially threatened as a human on this planet because I see the engineering and the technology that's being developed. And, you know, there's a portfolio of now 70 fusion companies. If any one of them works, we have free, abundant energy for the world. It's really profound. So that's my orientation, is let's go find those and help accelerate them.
Absolutely agree. And when I hear someone actually complaining about today or what's happening, like, can you imagine what people going through the plague would think about, or people 1,000 years ago? It's just crazy. How do you choose the area then to go and investigate with your team? And how do you decide then, okay, let's build a company, let's build a product, and then let's try to make it commercial?
I think choosing the area is really a function of where do we think there are advances that can enable 10, 100x orders of magnitude improvement in something. So you can look at some metric, whether it's the cost of production of proteins, the energy cost of production of proteins, let's say. Can we reduce the energy cost of beef from 30 to 1? It takes 30 units of energy to make a unit of beef in terms of its energy equivalency. Can we go to 10 to 1 or 3 to 1 or 2 to 1? I think that's the stuff that we're always looking out for, right? Are there therapeutics where the efficacy of those therapeutics can be 10 to 1 over the existing solution? Are there solutions in energy? You know, fusion is such a powerful example because, You know, around the world today, in the industrialized world today, the cost for electricity is roughly 11 cents a kilowatt hour. If we can get that cost to 1 cent a kilowatt hour, it doesn't just make the businesses more efficient that are consuming energy. It will completely transform the landscape of what businesses are possible because now electricity is so cheap. And so there's a 10x improvement in the cost of electricity. That's a tremendous advance. And there's certain tipping points. Like if we can get the cost of energy down by 75%, scalable desalination works everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so we can turn ocean water into fresh water at the same price as groundwater today. So we just need a 4x improvement in energy prices or 75% reduction in energy prices. So those are the sorts of things that we're always looking out for is where is this transformative potential. That's where we want to focus, not on the kind of 10% better stuff or 20% better stuff. And from there, it's like really what emerging technologies, whether we get those from meeting with scientists or academics or researchers or engineers, or we're reading papers internally, or our team's kind of efforts are around following a trail into the forest and finding something new that is just emerging. And then it's about the application of that capability into the market and really going deep. And often, again, we'll meet with lots of companies to try and figure out what's going to happen here. And in those meetings, we'll find a company we want to invest in, or we'll resolve to finding a team where no one's maybe doing it the way we think that it could be done. And we've got a great team to work on it, and then we'll work with them to build it. So it's a little bit fluid at that point in terms of whether we go down this path. You know, more often than not nowadays, you find incredible teams working on great projects, and they're very backable. And so we're increasingly doing a lot more kind of traditional venture investing across those opportunities.
Let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. What was the most challenging period in scaling the climate company, and how did you overcome it?
I tell people, we talked about this earlier today, but every day you feel like you're taking a step backwards, and one out of 5 days you take a 5-step leap forwards. So at the end of 5 days, you're one step ahead of where you started. But your existential memory is failure because 80% of the days you're taking one step backwards. And so it's a really kind of, you know, difficult thing to articulate well that there was this one moment. You know, we would launch our new product. We sold $35 million worth of the product or something like that, total weather insurance thing in 2011 or 2010. And then at the end of the year, we had a bunch of farmers complain. And they would complain and say, the weather didn't match what happened on my farm. Your data is bad. I didn't get paid out, but I had a drought. I got paid out, but I didn't lose yield. And so, you know, the product didn't work as we had anticipated for a chunk of customers. And then they got pissed and they started talking badly about us. And then you have to deal with all of that. You have, you know, all these issues with kind of market facing stuff, with product stuff, and then with kind of internal team op stuff. I mean, there's just no shortage of things to say, make things difficult. The hardest thing about agriculture, and I kind of discourage that, there's a joke that every entrepreneur or investor always tells people not to invest in the stuff that they've already done in the past because they realize how impossibly difficult it is. And so you'll go to, like, everyone that's in biotech is trying to leave biotech, and everyone that's in software is trying to leave software and go to biotech. And yes, you know, there's all these kind of funny jokes about how, you know, you can talk to anyone that's been in a market and you can perfectly predict that they'll tell you not to go into that market, whether it's insurance or biotech or software or hardware or consumer versus enterprise. I mean, you go like in all these different markets, you'll hear the same thing. Agriculture, I tell people, is difficult because you have a seasonal cycle. So you only get to sell once a year, and then you don't know till the end of the year how it's going. And in a startup's lifespan, that's a lot of time, right? You've now burned through a year of capital. And if you're only getting funded for 2 years, you just had one bite at the apple and you missed it. Now you're kind of scrambling to survive. So that's what makes agriculture very hard, is like the iteration cycle isn't like a consumer app where you can do pushes every day and try new things out. The iteration cycle is you get one bite at the apple. You have a couple of weeks to sell and a couple of weeks to gather data, and then you're done.
What is the worst advice you have received during your career?
The worst advice? That's a good question. I mean, I had some investors tell me at Climate when we were kind of building that software side of the business, because we saw how farmers were using our insurance products and valuing the software so deeply and how powerful it could be. I was really convinced that building software for agriculture could work and should be the future, and we should do that. And that's like it was hard because we were scaling this insurance business and it was selling really well, and we had all of our operational issues, sales channel conflict problems, how do we market, how do we get farmers to retain, how do we retain our agents from last year, just all the typical stuff that goes on with scaling a business. And it took a lot of work and a lot of effort, but at the same time we were spending time building the software thing, and people were like, what are you doing, you're unfocused, you gotta get the core thing working right, go back to first principles, flush all the excess stuff. And that was the wrong advice, because ultimately, like, my spidey intuition was that the software thing was the future and it's what we should be doing. And I was on the ground, I trusted myself, and I disregarded what the investors had told me and, like, vehemently told me and aggressively told me I should do, which is, like, stay focused on this thing. Don't make this investment. Don't make this don't spend this time on the software thing. And they were wrong. And so, you know, I do think, like, there's an element of, you know, I always tell people, there's a scene in the movie The Matrix. We've now referenced The Matrix twice today. I don't know why, but where Neo goes in to see the Oracle, and she's got this thing on her kitchen that says, "Know thyself." Yeah. You know, and she's like, no one can tell you if you're the one except you. And then she's like, okay, let me look at you. And then she looks at him and she's like, you're not the one. And then she kicks him out the kitchen and he eats a cookie. Like, you know, it's a really great scene, because it took him knowing himself and trusting himself and believing only in himself that he was the one, and that he would make this thing happen, that he could do all this amazing stuff, like warp reality, that gave him, like, the ability to actually do that stuff. I think the same is true, frankly, in this kind of unknown realm of entrepreneurship, where you're wandering around trying to build a business in an area that no one's ever done it before. And the best entrepreneurs are willing and open and able to listen to all the advice around them and hear everyone and take it in, but ultimately can know themselves to make a decision and to reorient the business based on what they feel is the right thing to do, not to just be told what their investors or their board's telling them to do. Can sometimes be a path to ruin. You know, there are many great VCs, from Founders Fund to Coastal Ventures, who, you know, take a very, I don't want to categorize the firms, but there are many firms who say, and Vinod has said this, Vinod Khosla, so maybe it is appropriate to put him in here in this bucket, but he's like, most VCs add negative value to a company because they feel like they have to give advice. And then the advice they give is uninformed because they're not on the ground at the entrepreneur building the business. So they're kind of being armchair quarterbacks, like the guy that sits at home watching football and he's telling the coach what to do. And there is an element of that. Then, you know, Founders Fund also takes a similarly kind of hands-off approach and really trusts the entrepreneur to drive successful outcomes. That's their orientation. And there's a lot of VCs who say they're active and value add, and maybe they are sometimes, but generally, you know, it's really important that in all those circumstances that the VC is not dictating to the founder what to do, that the VC really is providing, you know, counsel and advice and support and, you know, networks and helping with recruiting and all that sort of stuff, and really acts much more in service to the founder. Because at the end of the day, if the founder doesn't know thyself and can't make decisions themselves, you have a lower likelihood of success.
Know thyself. Love it. And the last question, if David from 20 years ago would listen to this episode, he was thinking to maybe build a business, what would you tell him?
20 years ago, what was I doing 20 years ago? 20, 22, 23. I was trying to build a business 20 years ago. I was working at this, it was my first job out of college, but right after that, I got this, I worked in banking, and I was enamored with, like, Silicon Valley and technology and what all these businesses were doing and building. And it was so cool. It was, like, really affecting the real world. I mean, my degree was in astrophysics. And so it was all kind of, to some degree, theoretical and looking out in the universe and, you know, predicting our place in the universe and, you know, very kind of, you know, esoteric stuff. And then being in Silicon Valley, meeting with lots of, I worked in banking for 2 years. I spent a lot of time with these guys, and it was so exciting. And I wanted to do something like that. I wanted to kind of be in the mix with, you know, what these guys were doing and building and affecting the world. And it was energizing. So I started spending my evenings learning how to code. I read, like, books on PHP and MySQL and how to set up a Linux server and how to run Apache and I wrote my own scripts for running these payment gateways. And I built this website called Kadanga, which was this Q&A site. And I advertised it on AdWords, and I got people to go to it, and then they paid with their credit cards to get people basically to do their homework for them and answer questions for them and do research projects for them. And it made a little money. It worked. It was really cool, but it wasn't going to scale. And so I think I would have been surprised to feel like in that moment, I guess I was aspiring in that moment to build something that was big and impactful and meaningful. But yeah, having gone through this, I think, you know, it would feel like what I had set out or always had this desire to do. I probably would have been disappointed in the scale. I mean, Peter Thiel always says you're either selling way too early or way too, either the buyer is overpaying or you're selling way too early and you're getting underpaid by 100x. You know, he's like, there's usually a 10 to 100x order of magnitude difference in the buyer or the seller in terms of their outcome. And it's hard for me to think like, did I leave the 100x on the table and always think about that? So yeah, I don't know how my younger self would feel about my story and kind of what I've come to.
But you mentioned this actually in another podcast, that the ambitions and dreams that you had when you were in college, actually you're a little bit disappointed that you don't think that actually you've achieved everything that you wanted.
You know, we all have lofty ambitions and aspirations and dreams. You know, changing the world is and was and would, I would say, be kind of the core motivator. Like, there's so many problems in the world. I want to change them all and I want to fix them all. I want to build like these massive kind of businesses that are just having incredible influence. So maybe to some degree, you know, the company I built has had a decent influence and a good outcome and it's used widely. But as I've gotten older, everything is in constant change. And so there is no absolute. You don't build a rock and the rock stands there for all time. The wind and the water erodes the rock. And I mean, you look at every great company. How many companies today existed 100 years ago, 500 years ago? There's a few, but they're not substantial. A
Japanese company.
Yeah, there's like one or two of these Japanese companies, but they're not super substantial. The great companies come and go, particularly in technology, those that lead. And we can talk about this for an hour about why this is the case.
It's an organism.
It's an organism, right? We're in a microbial consortia, and the consortia's, there may be some predominant species for a moment, but a few minutes later, the species shift happens and there's new species that emerge. And I think that enabling that change and that transition is kind of where I've resolved myself to, which is, how do I support and accelerate and participate in the changing of the guards, the constant changing of the guards in industry and in humanity that allows us as a species to move forward, that allows us to progress all that we're all going to benefit from, rather than pick the one thing and be the one influencer that does all of that, and just resign oneself to the fact that this is a constantly kind of evolving set of things. So yeah, I think that's the ego crush from childhood and from teenage years and college years, which is, there is no one big business or one big titan or one big entrepreneurial outcome that succeeds above all others and, you know, wins the day and lasts forever. As a result, I just kind of want to continue to participate in that motion versus the static outcome.
You will be the organism that helps all the organisms grow, right?
No, I would be the feedstock.
Yeah. And also, like, you're tackling like very, very difficult problems. It's not that, you know, it's a feature, but it's truly a problem that tries to replace maybe some inefficiencies in the value chain, or to create something 10 times cheaper or 10 times better.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what makes it fun and challenging and feels impactful that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, if I wanted to just make money, I could probably, you know, I don't know, be a day trader or something. I don't know. Those guys don't make money, but I mean, there's a lot of ways to make money in the world. I think, you know, tackling hard problems and creating value from it is hard, but fun.
That's definitely fun. Dave, such a pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, great to meet. Thanks for the time.